I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Laura Towler. Laura is the Deputy Director of the Patriotic Alternative in England, and she is a video maker. She's based in Yorkshire, and we've been friends for a while. We spent a whole afternoon wandering around together trying to dodge Antifa in Copenhagen last year. And I just wanted to bring her on and introduce her to more of my audience. So Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Yes, it's a pleasure to be here. I know we said in Copenhagen that we'd do a stream together sometime. So yeah, I'm glad we can finally do that.
Yeah, so I can't remember when you first came on my radar, but definitely when we were in Copenhagen, I got to know you. I was planning to meet up with a couple of people in Copenhagen at the Skanza Forum, and we were barred from getting into the actual venue by a mob of communists, basically.
Yeah.
It just so happened that two of the people that I was supposed to meet up with ended up spending the afternoon with me anyway, and also I met you for the first time in person and several other people, and it was a good time. It wasn't what we had planned, but I thought it was a worthwhile, rewarding time anyway, a bit of camaraderie, a chance to get to talk to people and so forth. So yeah, I'd like to just continue our conversations from that, I guess.
Yeah, it was an interesting weekend, wasn't it? Because I flew over with Matt Collette, because we live quite close to each other. And I know Frody because he spoke at our conference in England at the Patriotic Alternative Conference. So they invited me over and I saw you outside, and there was about maybe 100 of them surrounding the building, and we just couldn't get in, could we? So it was a nightmare as well, because I was wearing heels and we kept having to walk around, and my feet were bleeding by the end of the day. But it was a good experience and it was nice to meet everybody, and I would definitely do it again. Yeah, it's not put me off the whole sort of thing.
No, we're good at making something positive out of all these sort of unplanned curveballs that the enemy keeps throwing us. So that's how we win, I think. We don't let them stop us from having fun and networking and launching new projects. And so these people thought they could prevent us from meeting and communicating and organizing. And we just ended up meeting with, communicating with, and organizing with different people. So it sort of blew up in their face. And we have to do that all the time. Every time somebody gets doxxed, I always say to them, well, you know, you should make these people regret the day they doxxed you. You should go from being a furtive part-time hobbyist to a full-time bane of the establishment. And make them regret this.
Because you have nothing to lose, do you? So you might as well just think, well, screw it. And the conference went ahead anyway. So All they did was stand in the rain for about 7 or 8 hours with a big Soviet Union flag. and we all had a lovely day. So
yeah, it was a good time. So how did you get involved in all of this? How did you become a thought criminal?
Well, it was never really a conscious decision. I never thought I want to be an activist or I want to be a YouTuber. It was just a gradual thing that I kind of got dragged into, and then I kept being offered more and more opportunities and I just took them all. So for me, I grew up in a village in Yorkshire in the north of England that it was and it still is completely white, and it's one of those areas where if you see a foreign person you kind of do a double take and you think, what are you doing here? And then when I was in my late teens, I moved to Bradford for 2 years to live with my friend while she was at university there. And Bradford is famous. I'm not sure if you've heard of it, but it's famous for its Muslim population. They're everywhere. They have these communities that are 100% Muslim. And that was my red pill moment, really. It was just awful. The way that they speak to you, they come into your personal space and like stare at you and breathe in your face. And there were times when we got chased and we had to phone the police, and there were areas where we were told we weren't allowed to go, when we were grabbed hold of and spat at and all this horrible stuff. It went on for 2 years. So that was kind of the red pill that made me think there's something going on here. You know, we're not all the same. What's the problem? So I was just talking about things on Twitter, just with my little normie audience. And then I made friends with a couple of nationalists. They invited me to write for Defend Europa, which I did. And then I was promoted to editor of Defend Europa. And then I decided to make videos because I thought you can write an article and maybe 5,000 people read it. But I think my top video has maybe 250,000 views, so you can reach a much bigger audience. And then I made friends with like Mark Collett and Millennial Wars and Morgoth, and now I'm somehow a deputy leader of a political party. I never really planned that for myself, but it just kind of happened, and I'm committed to it because I care about England. But I think some people do get involved for like, I want the fame, or I want the money, you know, that kind of thing. It was never like that for me. I just kind of got dragged into it, and I was talking about things that were making me really angry or making me really upset. And also Bradford as well had a very bad, they say grooming gang, but it's a, you know, a Muslim rape gang. And I knew lots of girls that were affected by that. So yeah, that was a journey really. I feel like Mark is kind of responsible for pushing me into the deep end quite a lot. But we work together well, so yeah, it's going well.
So tell us what the Patriotic Alternative is, when it came about, what its goals are, how big it is, and so forth.
Yeah, so we're currently a few thousand big. We only started in August of last year, and it was basically because we were all making this content on the internet, and we're all sat around saying, you know, is someone going to do something about this? So we decided to form this IRL network, and in August we carried out the activism for We Were Never Asked. And then September, we had our first conference. And then October, the We Were Never Asked documentary came out. So it was kind of like end of summer, autumn that it came about last year. But there's two sides to Patriotic Alternative. There's a community building. So we have like a register mailing list that you can sign up for. And there are thousands of people on that mailing list. We have regular conferences, regular trips. So things like camping or going out to the countryside. We did We Were Never Asked. We have hubs all over Britain. So we have a Yorkshire one, one in the Midlands, one in London, and we're currently working on getting a Scottish one, but we want even more, you know, lots of hubs of, you know, like where we can centralise things. So that's one side of things. And then there's also the political side. So we've submitted a bid to be a political party in Britain. And we're not expecting to become Prime Minister overnight and save the West, but we do want to kind of get into some local elections, you know, and rock the boat a little bit, get into the media a little bit, shake things up. So it's those two sides of things really, because we can't promise that we can fix things through the political route, but we can promise that we will build a community, and no matter how bad it goes, how bad things end up in the future, we will always have each other. So that's the aim of it really.
Well, that's very, very encouraging, and I know Mark is a great person. He's a organizer, he's a very articulate spokesman, he's been doing this his whole adult life, so I'm glad you're working with him. What's it like to work with Mark?
Well, him and I are complete opposites, and you would think that that would mean that we wouldn't get on, but I think it makes us gel even more because we have different strengths and weaknesses. So like as friends we have the same sense of humor and we get on really well, but then as colleagues he's really kind of all guns blazing and kind of goes a little bit too far sometimes, and I think I kind of reel him back in a little bit, but then he pushes me forward a little bit, so we kind of balance each other out. He actually says that what is it when you take someone's weapons off them and you kind of make them feel a little bit more comfortable? He says I do that to people because I'm like a female and I'm just a normal person, whereas he has obviously 2 decades worth of experience and some documentaries and stuff made about him. So yeah, it works well together. He's very kind of confident, and then I'm a little bit more timid, I think, and a little bit more placid, but like I say, we just balance each other out, so it just seems to work.
Well, that's wonderful. So tell us about We Were Never Asked.
Yes, so this was a piece of activism that we did in August, and about 40 or 50 people went out into the streets on a Saturday afternoon. And we surveyed the British public on their thoughts on us becoming a minority in Britain. So we showed them 3 newspaper articles, one right-leaning, one local newspaper and one left-leaning, that gave some information about statistics about us becoming a minority. And we asked them if they knew about it, and then we asked them how they felt about it. People identified their ethnicity themselves. So we managed to survey 2,022 people who identified as being white British. And 70% of people said that they thought the British becoming a minority in Britain is a bad thing. Only 4.8% said that it was a good thing. And the rest of the people, it was 26.26%, said that they had no strong feelings about it. But a lot of them were kind of I mean, obviously you can't relay this when you're just giving hard data, but from our personal experiences on the day, lots of people were so scared about giving the wrong answer, and they were saying, that's racist, can you tell me the answer? I don't know what to say, you know, stuff like that. So I think if people were completely anonymous and it wasn't done face to face, the people saying that it was bad would have been even higher. But it was just such a white pill for us, because the media in Britain, I'm sure you read the articles, they make out that everybody loves this. You know, we've always been a nation of immigrants, diversity is our strength. But actually, if you get out there and you ask the British public, they're completely against what's happening.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. I think that the multicultural establishment is even more out of touch with the people than, say, the French aristocracy was before the revolution. They basically live in a bubble. They live in a world of delusion. They insulate themselves from the consequences of their own bad actions. They're constantly covering up things like rape gangs and terrorism and so forth. I really feel like their power is paper thin.
Yeah, absolutely. It only takes one flutter of a butterfly's wings, doesn't it, to change the course of history. And if we go back to like World War One and how that started, that was something that went on for, what, 80 years or something? Just a tiny little event triggered off something huge. And it could definitely do the same today. I mean, for all we know, behind the scenes, they're panicking and they're trying to present this really cool sort of calm persona. But you see them slip up sometimes, you know, the media and certain politicians and stuff. So who knows how far we are away from, like, breaking through and making real change.
Yeah, I think that we just have to believe in our message and believe that it's possible to break through and that the system is very, very hollow. One thing I always take comfort from is the fact that in 1989, all the smart people, all the experts were saying that communism was going to be around for a very long time. And by the end of that year, they were all proven wrong and it collapsed very, very quickly. The present regime is, well, first of all, it's based on the same lies that communism was based on, just another version of the same lies. And just as communism sort of hollowed out and people stopped believing it in the privacy of their own minds, but they weren't comfortable speaking about it in public because, of course, they could be attacked and arrested and harmed by the regime, I think a lot of people today really don't feel comfortable with this diversity stuff, but they're afraid of speaking out because they don't want to be attacked by the regime and its watchdogs. And so they stay quiet until maybe the ability of the system to intimidate them breaks down, or to intimidate lots of people breaks down. And suddenly people discover that the majority of Britons or the majority of Americans don't want to be replaced in their own homeland. And then once that happens, suddenly that becomes a politically potent force. We're not there yet, but there are plenty of signs, I think, to indicate that we're getting closer to that day.
Yeah, and just from the conversations that we had with people that day when we did We Were Never Asked, it's completely different to what you see on social media. If you go on social media, it's all these lovely lefty champagne socialists in London. They completely dominate. But then if you actually get out into the streets, especially into working class communities, they think all those idiots down in London are just delusional. So I think also with social media, because obviously we had a general election recently and Labour Party, they were just absolutely destroyed. And they're still really shocked about why they've been destroyed. They don't know. They're saying, is it anti-Semitism? And all this stuff. And it's like, it's because you've abandoned the white working class. Everyone else knows it apart from you. And I think because of the crippling hate speech laws that we do have in Britain, I mean, our law uses words like unfriendliness. Like if you show unfriendliness to somebody based on their race, religion, gender identity and all that stuff, it can be a criminal offence. So I think people are scared, but I think we are the silent majority. I really do.
Yeah. The argument I made about the necessity of freedom of speech is basically, if you're running a society, you need to know the bad news. If your ship is going full steam toward an iceberg and nobody will tell you about it because they're afraid that you'll get angry with them or something like that, or cancel their credit cards or throw them in jail or throw them off the internet or whatever, put them out of a job, well, you are putting yourself in a very vulnerable position because you're going to hit that iceberg. You're going to sink. And Therefore, the people in power, the very people who don't want us to speak out and share what we're thinking, and so have instituted all these speech codes, these laws, these terms of service, this internet censorship and so forth, they're the ones who need to know the most. You know, we need freedom of speech as a right so that people can tell bad news to powerful people who can punish them. That's the reason why it's so important, because if you don't get bad news, you can make terrible mistakes and society will suffer catastrophic failure. And we're seeing how these people are, they're failing because of their own censorship. They don't know what's going on, and so they're blindsided by the unpopularity of their policies. I think of Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was absolutely certain that she was going to be elected president. She was absolutely certain because she's, you know, a psychotic, probably murderous bitch who basically trained everybody around her to tell her what she wanted to hear, and therefore she never got an inkling of the bad news that she was not a popular candidate, and so it took her by total shock when she lost. And if she had actually been getting bad news and getting it early on, she might have been able to change her campaign and she could have actually won. So I think that the people in power themselves are the ones who need freedom of speech the most, even though they're the ones who want to suppress it. And the reason they want to suppress it is that they can't admit that they're wrong and that they have put the country, all of our countries really, on a course to disaster.
Yeah, it's like our Labour politicians just watching them scramble in the TV interviews after the election results came through. They have no idea why they've lost. And it's because, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn gave a speech just before we all went to vote and he stood up and he said, "My name's Jeremy Corbyn, my pronouns are he, him." And white working class folk look at that and just think, what a load of rubbish. And people just think, I'm not entertaining that anymore. And that up in the north where I am, we all kind of hate the Conservatives because Thatcher shipped a lot of our industries abroad. But even they've like kind of held their nose and voted for the Conservatives because they're so just embarrassed by Labour. Yeah. And also the not being able to talk about it thing. The one thing that really annoys me about that is, you know, like when Brenton Tarrant, was it the guy who killed the people in New Zealand?
Right.
We got a load of grief for talking about demographic replacement and they were saying, look what you're encouraging people to do. And it's like, we're only talking about the bad things that the politicians are allowing to happen. So if someone goes out and kills somebody because we relayed the truth, that's not our fault for talking about it. It's the fault of the politicians for allowing all these Muslims to rape little girls in the country. And they kind of classify telling the truth about an uncomfortable fact as worse than actually doing the uncomfortable deed. Does that make sense?
I know that's what they do. Of course, it doesn't make sense. It's insanity.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There's this old saying about, you know, don't punish the bearer of bad news. Why? Because if you're in charge, you need to hear the bad news. And free speech is there to prevent powerful people from punishing bearers of bad news. And we just have to constantly say, look, we're not advocating all this violence. We're just warning you that it's an inevitable consequence of the policies that these people have put in place. They're the ones who are creating the conditions of hatred and violence. We're just the bearers of the bad news. And we're the only people who are actually conceiving of fixing it. We're the only ones who have a strategy for fixing this. These people just want to deny it. They want to basically continue these policies that will only make things worse and just censor everybody and prevent them from talking about it.
Yeah, they genuinely want us to just see something and then be like, oh, I'm not allowed to talk about that, so I better just be silent. And then it just continues and you just think, absolutely no way am I just going to allow this to continue and not talk about it. But I mean, we have had people sent to prison in England for, you know, just saying offensive things on the internet. So that is kind of one of my concerns. I'll go as far as I can politically and kind of culturally and socially, but one day they could send me to prison for saying something which is just a fact. But I guess that's the nation that we live in nowadays.
Yeah, it's sad. And I do think that more and more of us are going to just have to risk being, you know, sent to prison, being beaten up, being attacked and so forth, because that's the only way we're going to win. We just have to take these necessary risks. If we don't do it, nobody else will. That's what it is to lead.
And also the opposite choice is to just sit silent and do nothing and lose your nation. And that's not a choice that I'm willing to take. So the risk of going to prison is more appealing than just the idea of sitting silent and losing England.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's scary to be persecuted by the state. It's even scarier if we do nothing. And so we have to keep that always in mind. As scary as the things that these people are trying to do to us, it's far, far worse if we do nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And at Patriotic Alternative, because I'm currently working on the manifesto with Mark, one of the things that we've spoken about in there is freedom of speech. And we've said anybody who's in prison for offence will be instantly released. And if you are sentenced to prison, it will be based on actual damage, not hurt feelings, because that's what it does feel like in Britain at the moment. Like I said, with the hate crimes, they talk about just being unfriendly to somebody, or it's not even, you don't even have to threaten somebody, you know, just calling somebody the wrong thing. And it could be like, right, that's a hate crime. Here's your sentence. And it's just mental. I mean, we do laugh at it, and we do laugh at the police over here as well, because I don't know if you've seen the pictures or the videos of them walking down in pride parades with rainbow face paint on the faces. It's just so embarrassing, and we do laugh at it, but really it is deadly serious, and we need to change this in the future.
Yeah, I've seen some of these hilarious pictures. They can dress up and pander to marginal communities, but they can't prevent little girls from being raped by the thousands.
Yeah, they have a diversity and inclusion budget, and they spend it on things like rainbow stickers for their cars, which cost £750 per car. It's just crazy.
How is it possible for a sticker to cost £750?
I don't know. But that's
it's pure corruption. That's one of the things that I find so amazing about left liberal regimes. In Seattle, the left liberal city government decided, you know, we need bike lanes everywhere because traffic isn't congested enough, so we need to take some space from cars and make bike lanes. And basically creating bike lanes for the most part consists of painting lines on the streets. And it came out that the city of Seattle was spending $1 million for every mile of bike lanes. And it's just totally shocking, because the other side, the flip side of all this airy-fairy talk about, you know, progress and so on and so forth, is incredible cynicism and corruption. And we really have to hit them on that, I think, as well, because that is definitely a weakness that these people have. They are incredibly corrupt, double-dealing people at the same time as they preach stupid and frivolous and oftentimes terribly destructive progressive ideas.
Yeah, we should definitely highlight the hypocrisy of the stuff that they put forward as well, because our government is always going on about the environment, but then they won't address population increase, which over 80% comes from immigration, either direct immigrants or their descendants. So they're always putting forward these policies to help save the environment and stuff, but then they'll build a load of houses on like wetland, because there's no land left apart from like farmland, forest, mountains, countryside, that kind of stuff. So now they're building houses on wetland, which is damaging towards the environment there, you know, the birds and stuff, but it's also just unsafe. And I just think, how can you like go and give that speech where you pretend to care about the environment, but then at the same time you're damaging it? It's just hypocrisy nonstop from them.
Well, this is why the whole climate change thing has become the focus of environmentalism, because it basically sidesteps all issues of population. Suddenly, it's just climate change. That's the only thing we have to worry about. And it turns out that climate change is now a universal excuse for mass migration. And now they're talking about making it impossible to return refugees from climate change to their homelands, because that would be just too cruel. And so there is something very, very suspicious about the whole climate change ideology, not only because the climate change claims seem to be false and fraudulent and hysterical, but also what it deflects people from, which is the population question. And the population growth problem is coming entirely from the non-white world.
Yeah, I just find it, I just can't have any enthusiasm for it because, like you say, they're not addressing the main cause, which is a population increase from Africa and the Middle East. And like, I am quite conscious of the environment. So like, I, you know, recycle and I usually try and walk places and that kind of stuff. But then when you've got countries like India and China, the amount of rubbish that they're dumping in the sea and in rivers, I just kind of think, why are you nagging us all the time? It just seems to me like another tool which is used to bash white people. And you'll have seen the articles where it's always, you know, a white couple on the front, you need to stop having kids. And I can't get on board with it because it just seems like another scam. And also, this has been going on since before I was born. Didn't they say that the world was going to end in like the 2000s or something? And then it was, before that, it was like in the 1980s. They just tend to like kind of give it a different name and then like repackage it and address us again with it every 20 years or so.
Yeah, but there is a common denominator, and it's always give power to unaccountable global institutions run by the very people who are putting forward these alarmist claims. That is the one thing that all of these apocalyptic claims have in common. There was a time, I think in the 70s, where they were warning that there was going to be a new ice age, that global cooling was the great Armageddon. Then it became global warming. Now, because, well, if we have a couple cold years, people say, well, I guess global warming is off. Now it's climate change, because the climate is always changing. So everything is evidence for climate change, right? So I think that, yeah, there's a huge amount of fraud here. And the fraud always seems to be directed against white people. We are always the villains here. And the solutions always point to the same groups being empowered in a way that's dictatorial and unaccountable. It's a scam. Another giant scam of the left is feminism. I remember when I was in college hearing outrageous claims that one in every two or one in every four women is sexually abused or raped or whatever in her lifetime. And I always just thought that was preposterous. That's totally ridiculous. Where are these feminists getting these numbers, right? Then I heard about Rotherham. And then suddenly we started getting data that almost supported these outrageous claims that feminists were making about the level of violence that women were being subjected to. But because the victimizers are non-white and the victims are primarily white, what do we get from feminists? Crickets. They're absolutely unconcerned with this. Their silence speaks volumes. Feminism is an anti-white scam, an anti-white, anti-Western scam. They're not concerned with women. They're primarily concerned with just basically monkey wrenching healthy white societies. And promoting women's liberation has caused catastrophic declines in white birth rates. And I really just look at feminism for the most part, as it's practiced today, as just a form of demographic warfare against white people. And the very fact that the feminist establishment is totally unconcerned with non-white victimization of white women basically gives it all away, in my opinion.
Yes, and they also change their response depending on who the victim and the perpetrators are. So obviously, I live in Yorkshire, so all the kind of big grooming gangs, or a lot of them, have happened right on my doorstep. So Rotherham is in South Yorkshire. We had one in Leeds, Bradford, Huddersfield, Sheffield were some of the major ones. I mean, we've had them all over the country, but a lot of the famous ones are in Yorkshire. And I haven't been affected by it firsthand, but a lot of the girls I went to school with, some of my sister's friends have been. And I know what it's like living amongst Pakistanis, because I lived in Bradford for 2 years, and they're just completely different to white men. The way, it's a cultural thing, the way that they treat you, it's not an individual thing. But if I told my story and I said, oh, this Pakistani man did this, then I know a feminist would be like, yeah, but that's just one individual, they're not all like that. But then if it was a white man, they'd be like, crush the patriarchy and all that rubbish. And yeah, I think over time you do just notice a hypocrisy again and again and again, and it's our job to kind of relay that to the rest of the public.
Probably the most evil movie I've ever watched is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Because that film, which was based on a novel, there are two versions of it now, the Swedish one and then the English one. But that film, based on a novel by a Swedish communist, basically shows Sweden as a country where women are being constantly harassed and raped by Swedish men, and that the victims, the poor victims of these Swedish predators are non-white women, Jewish women, immigrant women, and so forth. And the person who wrote this novel, he's dead now, he knew the truth. He knew that in Sweden, the primary victims of rape are white women and the primary perpetrators of rape are non-whites. He knew that, and he created this story that is a complete 180-degree inversion of the truth. And I just think that's pure evil. There's no possible explanation for this aside from just lying to cover up evil and perpetuate evil against the native population of that country. And everywhere we have leftists, they do the same thing. They do it in Sweden, they do it in England, they do it in the United States.
You know, I have actually seen that film, but it was so long ago that I saw it that I don't even think that stood out to me. What year did it come out?
Oh gosh, sometime before 2010. I think it came out before 2010.
So. Yeah, so I might have been quite young and not really like conscious of all this stuff. But yeah, that's mental. And you know, in Sweden as well, the thing that annoys me is they have a weird classification of rape. So if a man rapes his wife every day for a week, it goes down as 7 rapes, whereas in most other countries that would only go down as 1 rape. So that is partly why Sweden's rape statistics are so high. But even if we take that away, it's still very, very high. But leftists kind of use that as an excuse to just kind of, you know, brush it under the carpet and not talk about it anymore. They say, oh, well, the figures are dodgy in Sweden, so let's not address it. And it's like, no, it's still something that we need to address. It's just that the figures might look, you know, 10% higher than they actually are or whatever. And they do that. They have all these get out clauses where they'll just, rather than addressing the information, they'll look for a way that they can discredit it. And it's just infuriating because I just think, do you even know how bad the thing that you're doing is? But yeah, they just seem to have their hands over their eyes and their fingers in their ears.
Yeah, well, not just that. They're trying to poke out your eyes and prevent you from hearing the bad news, too. If they were only doing it to themselves, it wouldn't be as big a problem as it is. But they're not only deluding themselves, they're trying to delude everybody else and just keep these problems simmering along and getting worse. It's utterly criminal. It's utterly shocking. And honestly, when I heard about Rotherham, I thought, oh, my God, the streets of Britain are going to be flowing with rivers of blood, like Enoch Powell said. It hasn't happened yet, but this is so shocking, and it impeaches the entire establishment. It impeaches the left, and it impeaches the right. I mean, the left are the ones who are actively creating excuses for this, and it's their policies that cause these colonies of rapists to form in England. But the right, they'll never do anything about it. They just want to avoid the topic because they're afraid that if they really have to confront the topic, they're going to have to do mean things that will get them bad press in The Guardian, that there will be angry leftists who will wag their fingers at them and shame them. And so, well, it's a small price to pay that girls are raped to avoid some socially uncomfortable interactions that they imagine will happen if they actually try and stop this.
Yeah, we even had a study that revealed that 84% of grooming gang perpetrators were, well, they called them Asian, but they're mainly Pakistanis. So Pakistanis are only 2% of the population. So that's a huge overrepresentation. And when our government was presented with that study, rather than saying, oh my God, we have a problem here, what should we do about it? They just tried everything that they could possibly do to discredit the study. And they do exactly the same with violent crime, which we have a problem with black youths and violent crime. And they'll be like, oh, it's because the police are racist. And then it turns out that the police aren't racist and their arrest rate matches their conviction and their prison rate. And then it's the same for white people as well. And then they'll say, oh, it's because, you know, black people are in poverty. And I think it's 33% of black people in Britain live in poverty, but 31% of white people do. So it's like, oh, we can't use that excuse. And then it's like, oh, we need community building and rehabilitation and we need more ping pong tables and, you know, youth centres and stuff. And it's like, oh, my God, can we just address the issue that this is a racial problem and that black people are more prone to crime? And they just won't do it at all. And I just think it's not your daughter that's been stabbed in a park, is it? Or it's not your wife that's having acid thrown in her face. But I even think if it did happen to them directly, they would still try to ignore it, because you see people whose family members have been in terror attacks and they still come out and say, oh, he supported open borders, he wouldn't have wanted division. And I just want to shake these people. They infuriate me so much.
Yeah, they're not serious people. They're basically brainwashed zombies. But really, what we've got here is this phenomenon of how a disastrous war will argue for its own continuation. Because if people have lost a huge amount in a disastrous war, stopping the war requires them to admit that all of the losses were for nothing. And so people will continue policies that are disastrous because it's psychologically harder for them to admit that it was a disaster and that everything has been lost, that nothing good is going to come out of it, and especially that they're guilty. That they're guilty of creating terrible conditions. People are vain. People want to feel good about themselves. People want to feel good about themselves. People resist being confronted with the negative side of their personalities, the negative consequences of their behavior. This is why we need freedom of speech again. Because if we don't have that, then what you get with narcissistic people, and everyone's got a bit of narcissism, people will try and avoid anything that will make them feel bad about themselves, even if they really deserve it, even if they should feel bad for the consequences of their bad action.
Nobody wants to say, I was wrong, do they? Are I was complacent. So it's like when you get into an argument or a debate with somebody, like I used to do quite a lot on Twitter, but I've stopped doing it over the last 6 months or so. They never say, yeah, okay, you're right, I apologise. It's always, you know, a block and drop out of the conversation or just arguing pointless things that they know aren't correct. So yeah, I just wish that people kind of would take a step back and say, like, wow, this is a situation that we're in. We're going to change things. But we're not going to change things with this two-party system that we have in Britain. And I don't know if you saw Boris Johnson a few days ago. He's now dropped the cap on immigration. It used to be you had to be earning a £30,000 salary a year to be able to come. He's now dropped that cap, or he's on his way to dropping it. He said he will. So now we can have, you know, low-skilled immigrants coming in from outside of the EU. So Labour and Conservatives are just two sides of the same coin, and that's really why we're trying to push a new party, a new machine with Patriotic Alternative, and hopefully we can get some support.
So tell me about your sense of the political landscape in the UK. Are you optimistic? Do you think that the movement there is growing? Do you think you're getting better people? Are you forming new organizations? There was a big vacuum created after the British National Party collapsed. And I'm wondering, is anything coming along to fill in that vacuum now that you think is viable?
Well, for a long time, we've only had parties like UKIP, the Brexit Party, and For Britain, who kind of, they say a few basic kind of centre-right talking points, but then they'll never like fully address the demographic issue. And then they will also focus just on the effect of what's happening. You know, they'll talk about radical Islam, but they won't say these people are bringing them here, or, you know, even just converting from Islam to atheism or Christianity won't fix things. We need to look at race. None of them have done that. So that's why we thought, you know, rather than supporting one of these parties, we'll just create our own. And I know people are saying, oh, another party, but the reason that we're different to all the others, them three are similar in lots of ways, but we are a real nationalist party, you know, a Britain for the ethnically British. So yeah, our support is growing. You know, me and Mark have got YouTube channels which are growing quite fast. The Patriotic Alternative website, we've only had it for about 2 months, I think. And Mark deals with all the registrations, but I know that thousands of people have registered on the website. We also get a lot of emails from people saying, you know, I've been waiting for a long time to do something. What can I do? Just tell me what I need to do. People offering to volunteer for further pieces of activism. The conference that we're having in spring, which will be our second conference, it just sold out instantly. So the last one was around 100 people. This one's bigger and it just sold out instantly. So we have a waiting list for it. So, yeah, it does feel like there's something kind of bubbling under the surface and a lot of people are wanting to get involved. Like I said earlier, if you just get all your information from the mainstream media and if you just look at what people are saying on social media, you would think that we were all like mental kind of champagne socialists, you know, like global elitists and stuff. But if you actually get away from London and go out into the communities, especially in the north, everyone's just normal. You know, they just have the same views as me and Mark and they don't find any of this stuff offensive at all. So, yeah, I do think that we have a majority of people and I do think that we will be able to get a lot of support. The media will no doubt attack us and try and misrepresent us, but we just have to ride it out. And yeah, I mean, like I said at the start, I can't promise that we can fix things politically, but we will be able to build a community because we've already done that and that community is growing daily.
That's very exciting. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. And I do hope that your party takes off because you do have a system that's more conducive to new parties coming along than the United States, which really seems to be saddled with this two-party system. So I think, you know, you and Mark are really, really good people. I think that if you build a party with really good people, that things are going to happen. One book that I read back in 2018 that really impressed me is Roger Eatwell and Matthew Goodwin's book, National Populism. And they make some very, very encouraging arguments about the groundswell of national populist sentiment, basically in the white countries of the world. And I wonder, do you follow any of their arguments? I know Matthew Goodwin is on Twitter, for instance. He's commented a lot about the Brexit campaign and referendum and the attempts of the establishment to stop it and so forth. I think that they offer some very, very encouraging analysis that your party might build on and that the movement in general might build on.
Yeah, Matthew Goodwin is not bad. I mean, he's not our guy by any means, but he does seem to be a little bit more rational than the other academics. And I do follow him on Twitter and he is very good for cold, hard facts and statistics. And then he doesn't kind of give this, you know, whinging lefty spin on things. So Matthew Goodwin is a good guy to follow for anyone who's listening because he does sort of give the cold, hard facts about what's happening in Britain. But I've not read that book. Is it the one, does it look like an old Penguin book with the wave on the front?
Exactly.
Yeah, I should get that because a few people have recommended it.
Yeah, I recommend it to all the people in the movement who read and who are thinking in terms of strategy and organizations and so forth, because it does really give perspective on how long these trends towards the breakdown of the existing system have been at work and what kind of opportunities that gives nationalists and populists right now and on into the future, because they project that these trends are not going to disappear, that they're going to just intensify, and that basically politics is going to realign away from the dominance of the globalist paradigm towards some form of national populism, whether it's radical or watered down. They basically think that the future paradigm for politics is going to be national populism. And that's really an environment that we can't lose in.
Yeah, and do you know the interesting thing about that is that if other academics did realise that, they probably wouldn't admit it. So I wonder how many other people are kind of thinking, oh, we kind of tend to be swaying in this direction, but, you know, we better not give them a bit of encouragement or enthusiasm, because they try and make out like we're a very sort of small fringe movement, don't they? You know, like with all these, I get journalists contacting me saying, I'm really interested in your views. Can I do an article about you? And I just think, no, because I don't want you to publish my views as being strange or just, you know, like a minority representation in this country. My views are completely mainstream. And they try and hide that. And also we have the Hope Not Hate State of Hate report coming out any day now. And they I was in the one last year, but I just had like a couple of paragraphs, sorry, a couple of sentences and a small picture. So I'm hoping for a bigger feature this year. But
the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it's like the Oscars of the British far right. But yeah, I was in it last year with Millennial Woes, Morgoth, Mark Collett and Tara McCarthy. So we're all kind of looking to see who will be in it this year. But they just take normal people and views. And it's like, Laura Towler does not want to be a minority in her country. Look how bad she is. And it's like, that's not a bad thing, guys. You know, most people are going to look at that and think, yeah, neither do I. So, yeah.
In 2001, after the September 11th terrorist attacks, NBC and Reuters did polls of the American public asking them what they thought was the cause of this terrorist attack. And this was the weekend after the attack. The weekend was on the attack was on a Tuesday. I heard this the following weekend. And 66 and 67% of the American public believed that the reason we were attacked was our relationship with Israel. And I looked at that and I thought, wow. The entire establishment is in overdrive trying to obfuscate the Israel connection here, and two-thirds of the public see it. Well, I think it was the following week that the New York Times put a face on a position that was held by two-thirds of the American public. They went to the compound, in quotes, of William Pierce in the mountains of West Virginia. William Pierce, the leader of the neo-Nazi National Alliance, was the face that they put on an opinion that was held by two-thirds of the American populace. This, I just think, is diabolical. This is how they work. They try and take majority positions and stigmatize them by basically attributing them to scary, weird people. And the fact of the matter is that our views are not scary and weird at all. We are the majority. And they will do all their diabolical chicanery to prevent people from realizing that we're the normal ones and that our views are the views of the majority of the populace. Because once the populace realizes that, then their days are numbered. And I already think their days are numbered. I just think it's a matter of time because they really can't control information. Not like they could in the past when the United States had basically three TV networks, right? And all the newspapers were being fed their stories from a few news agencies. And there was basically total top-down control over the mainstream media. They don't have that anymore. And therefore, they can't really keep us bamboozled like they did in the past.
Yes, and I know that you're big on your movies as well. But they do it with films, don't they? Like American History X, where they take completely normal talking points and then they put them into the mouths of these, you know, skinheads with swastika tattoos and these horrible, violent people. And then they parrot them through them. And the stuff that Derek says in American History X, I'm sure you have many opinions on that film. It's just normal stuff. I agreed with like 90% of what he said, but they make them out to be scary because a neo-Nazi is saying them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is one of the things that they do a lot, and I've talked about this. For instance, my review of the Martin Scorsese film, Gangs of New York, they take views that are very, very sensible, and they put them in the mouth of this criminal, Bill the Butcher. They do that a lot. This is the only way that Hollywood will allow certain truths to be spoken, and they always put them in the mouths of villains as a way of basically stigmatizing these views. They realize that they can't completely prevent these views from being entertained. And so what they try to do is they try and identify them with people who are marginal or scary or evil, stupid, crazy, evil people, right? But it's just an attempt to contain things. And I think it's just an attempt to slow down the inevitable. And I do think they're really smart people, and there are some smart people in the establishment. I mean, they're all smart in terms of, not all of them. Maxine Waters isn't very smart. But most people in power are at least clever in the IQ department. Where they really fail is their lack of honesty, for the most part. But some of them are clever and honest enough to realize, I think, that the game is up and that really the establishment's only choice at this point is to manage its decline. And I think that we are on the right side of history, in other words. Ours is the big wave that's rising. Their paradigm is collapsing. They're going to delay the inevitable as long as possible. They're going to draw it out as long as possible. Then they're going to try and change sides at the last minute. We know what they're going to try and do. And I think that we just have to keep pressing forward and have faith in our message and realize that we are going to win. They're delaying it. They're delaying it constantly, but I don't think they can beat us in the end.
Yeah, have you also seen them doing it with the Trad Wives movement as well?
You know, I haven't. I've seen a few tweets, but I haven't dug into that yet. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's just come to Britain, so I've seen it in America. I think it was last year I saw the media talking about it in America, but it's just come to Britain this week, and they're linking that so that they've been having these interviews with women that call themselves Trad Wives on the radio, and it's just normal, lovely women. I've listened to a couple of them and thought, oh, she's nice, I'd like to be friends with her. And they're just saying, like, you know, I've got three kids and I want to spend time with them. So my husband earns money, he gives a bit to me, I have a house budget, etc., etc. And like, feminists are getting really, really, really upset with it. But the media are linking being a trad wife to white supremacy. And I just kind of think, how, first of all, how have you made that connection? But also, why are you trying? Well, we know why, don't we? Why are you trying to demonize just nice white women who want to be a wife and have lots of children? And it's like, it's the most wholesome, purest thing that you can want to do. And they're trying to make it out to be evil in the media at the moment.
Well, good luck. Good luck. They can try. And they'll pick off some empty-headed people and superficial people. They'll go along with it. But chances are, smart people will see through this and start investigating this. Smart women are going to say, yeah, what's so bad about this? Sounds like fun. I mean, the idea that being a mother is being presented as tyranny, whereas working for a boss is liberation. I just think that's crazy. That's what they're selling women these days. It's tyranny to have a husband and children and work for them, and it's freedom to work for a mega corporation.
Yeah, it's fine to be submissive to a boss because you get money out of it, but it's not okay to be submissive to your husband to have a family out of it and, you know, have a close relationship with your family. And that's just, it sums up our society today, doesn't it? Consumerism is heralded over family values. And yeah, it's just, I do hope that some people will just look at that and think, you sound absolutely crazy. That's a perfect life that I would have. And when I was a kid as well, my dad has a manual job. I won't say what because people might be able to find him, but my mum worked a couple of cleaning jobs on the side, you know, just for a bit of extra money. So we couldn't really afford to just have one parent working. But I know for a fact that if my mum could have afforded it, she would have been at home with us all the time because she would have just wanted to spend all the time with us. And that's what I'd like to do when I have children, but I probably will have to work a little bit as well. So if women can do that, then good on them. I think it's absolutely fantastic. And I don't see why any other women would want to shame them for it.
Yeah. One thing that people don't understand, too, is the fact that it's increasingly difficult for a man to support a wife and family on one income is caused by two factors. Basically, it's the same factor. There's more competition in the labor market. The two sources of competition in the labor market are immigration and women getting jobs. When women get jobs, they lower the price of labor, which makes it more necessary for other women to get jobs because it's harder for a man to support a wife and family on a single income. And so it's a situation analogous to the following. This is something that Roger Devlin talked about. Imagine you're at a baseball game or a football game and somebody stands up in the bleachers to get a better view of everything on the field. Well, the people behind him have to stand up too. And if a few people are allowed to stand up to gain an advantage over others, everybody will end up standing up. They'll all be back in the same position as they started relative to one another. and they'll all be uncomfortable because they're all standing. And it's just an example of destructive competition where some people decide that they want to get a little extra, a little leg up on other people. And at the beginning of that process, it works for them. But as the process continues, they're all back to where they started, but they're all less comfortable. Everybody's income is basically the same at the end of this process of women going to work. Now it takes two breadwinners to have a house and a family, whereas in the past it took one. And so you've got the same standard of living as you did at the beginning of the process, but you have two people now working full-time. And the kids at home are getting less parenting because of it. So it's a beautiful example of how freedom fails. Sometimes being free to compete and gain extra advantages for yourself as an individual produces socially dysfunctional, undesirable outcomes where everybody's basically back in the same position. They don't have any advantages, and they've actually lost a lot of freedom in the process. So these are the kinds of things that the state needs to get involved in to prevent this kind of destructive competition. Another example of this is businesses going from, you know, being open during normal business hours, as we used to think of them, to being open 24 hours. There are a lot of businesses that are open 24 hours in urban areas. And, you know, a 24-hour bakery doesn't sell any more bread than a bakery that's open 9 hours a day. And they have to employ people to work and keep the lights on and stuff like that. But the reason why companies will do this is because some of them are allowed to do this. They're allowed to set their own hours, and so others have to compete. And in the end, everybody is, because they're all free to compete, they're all stressed out, and they've gained no advantage from this. But what's lost is private life. Private life has been eroded away. And that's really just an example of how freedom fails. And why state regulation is a good thing.
Yeah, I always wondered, like, because the big supermarket near me is Asda, and that is open 24 hours a day. And, you know, I always wondered, do people go there at, like, 3 o'clock in the morning? But you only have to look at the happiness levels of women to learn that they're not fulfilled by this way of life. And I think there was a study, actually I wrote about it for Countercurrents for you. There was a study that showed that if you look at the happiness levels from women from, I think it was 1970 to the present day, they've been dropping. And then in the 1990s, men actually overtook them. So men became happier than women for the first time. And they're just getting worse and worse. You know, they're popping all these pills, they're listening to Adele and having a cry in the shower. And they're not fulfilled by this way of life, but they're still chasing it. And we have all these crazy diversity quotas over here. We need to get women into science, and we need to get women into politics. They don't want to do it. That's why they're not choosing those jobs. But we're trying to force it with diversity quotas. And it's just mental.
Yeah, it's so sad. There is a saying that I really like that describes sort of the emptiness of consumerism. You can't get enough of what you don't really need. And people are running themselves ragged, pursuing things that don't really satisfy them. And that's no way to live. That is the definition of the rat race. It's the definition of empty calories. It's the definition of addictive lifestyles. You can't get enough cigarettes, but you don't really need cigarettes. You can't get enough snacks, empty calories. Why can't you get enough of them? Because you don't really need them. They don't satisfy you. If they satisfied you, there would be enough. And I think that that's really true of consumerism, too. It's not a satisfying way of life, which is why people are so hell-bent on getting more of it.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't really have anything else to add. But, I mean, I guess it's the power of advertising and the power of societal pressure and stuff like that. But, yeah, it's very sad the way we're going.
Yeah, well, people are convinced by advertising and education that they're missing out on really, really great stuff by not having a career working for a multinational corporation. They convince women that they could have it all and that there's this conspiracy of men to keep them from working in coal mines. and on roofing crews and in sewers. You know, there's absolutely no demand for employment parity in dangerous, dirty jobs. That is kind of a revealing thing. There's no demands for women to be 50% of long-distance truckers or 50% of coal miners. Or 50% of people on SWAT teams or things like that. It's all like the well-remunerated, clean, high-status jobs. So, Laura, we should wrap up. We've been talking for about an hour. How do people find your work? And also, are there other writers, bloggers, video makers, and so forth that you recommend that people check out? I can put this all in the show notes.
Well, it was lovely to talk to you. I'm a big fan of Countercurrents, as you know, but I have one of your books, Toward a New Nationalism, which I picked up at Erkin Brand, which I need to read, so I'm looking forward to reading that. But I'm on YouTube and BitChute at Laura Towler, and I guess the people that I would recommend are the people who I'm like having my friendship group. So obviously Mark, Morgoth and Keith Woods, who I saw you interview recently as well, I think.
Yeah.
But I've chosen for myself to sort of sit at the gateway, you know, and beckon people in towards nationalism. So their content is probably a little bit more highbrow than mine. But that's the stuff that I like, I can learn things from them. I can watch a Morgoth video and be like, oh, wow, that's interesting. I've never thought of it like that before. So yeah, they're the people I'd recommend.
Well, I have just put up an interview with Morgoth today. We're recording this on a Friday the 24th, and I just put up my Morgoth interview today at Countercurrents. So, and I have done Keith Woods. I've been a guest on Mark's show a number of times, and I've met him a number of times. So yeah, I appreciate that. Laura, thank you so much for all the good work you do, and let's have another conversation like this very soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, right back at you. Thank you for all the work you've done. And I'd love to talk to you anytime. Thanks, Greg.
Well, thank you.